Welcome back to the Logic Consortium. Today on the show, we have Professor of Middle Eastern Studies, James Gelvin, talking about one of his books, The Modern Middle East, a history. We're talking about the 2008 edition, the second edition of the book, and we're going to be talking about a bunch of issues surrounding the book, mainly that a lot of the movements, particularly some of the Islamist movements that we see in the Middle East, are really modern in the sense of the word, that they are responses to events in the region and in the world. So please stick around. It's going to make for a very interesting interview. Thanks so much for listening to Logic Consortium, and thanks so much to Professor Gelvin for joining us. Okay, so I'm ready to jump right into it.
Sure. Sounds good to me.
I'd love if you could start off by reviewing some of the British and French involvements in the Middle East after World War I, describing the mandate system.
The mandate system was actually a strange compromise. It was a compromise between the British and the French, on the one hand, who wanted to impose a colonial system on the Asiatic provinces of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire had been defeated in the First World War. And what these guys wanted to do, the British and the French, was that they wanted to divide up these territories among themselves and to establish this sort of colonial regime like they had in India. The Americans, on the other hand, didn't want that to happen at all. What the American foreign policy had been based on since the 1890s was an open-door policy. And the last thing that the Americans wanted to see was colonial powers prohibiting American interests in the region. So you have this sort of impasse taking place, and the system that was worked out was a system of partial colonialism, partial free trade. In other words, according to Article 22 of the Charter of the League of Nations, there were several types of mandates that were set up, and mandates were not just in the Middle East, of course. There were mandates in Africa, and mandates in the Pacific Islands, and mandates actually in East Asia as well. But the ones in the Middle East were called Class A mandates, and those were the ones that were established because people were, the idea was that these territories are almost ready for independence. So the idea was that the British and the French would go in there and prepare these people for the strenuous life of the civilized world. And in the meantime, they would be able to divide up territories, push territories together, set boundaries fairly arbitrarily on their own. The one thing they couldn't do, though, was to restrict trade in any way. So in that way, the idea that, number one, there would be, over a long period of time, self-determination, that trade would not be restricted, was something thrown at the Americans. On the other hand, the idea that the British and the French would have their interests represented was something that was very, very similar to the old colonial system. The mandate system in the Middle East took place only in the Asiatic provinces. In other words, the territories that are now Lebanon and Syria, Jordan, Israel, Palestine, and Iraq. In Lebanon and Syria, the French got the mandate. For every place else, the British got the mandate. And when I say the territories that were to become, I've chosen my words very carefully there. Because there was no such thing as Iraq, there was no such thing as Syria or Lebanon. These things were the creations of the mandatory powers. So they drew the boundaries fairly arbitrarily based upon imperial needs, the needs of the British and French on the one hand, promises that they had made both to each other and to local elites, and finally assumptions that they had about the area. That, for example, their Christians and Muslims would never be able to get along in a single state, so what you have to do is to create a predominantly Christian state, which became Lebanon, for example, and was severed from Syria. There were all sorts of problems with doing this. I mean, for example, the British, in order to resolve a local problem that they were having, created Jordan, severed Jordan from the Palestine Mandate and created it as a proto-state in its own right. This solved the British problem, but Jordan, of course, is an economic basket case. There's really no reason why Jordan, economically, should exist as a state. In the case of Iraq, what you had was a very different sort of problem. the, as you, your listeners know from based on current events, the north is predominantly Kurdish, Sunni. The central area is predominantly Arab, Sunni. And the southern area is predominantly Shi'i, Arab. So you have three different groupings divided by ethnicity, divided by sect. And these three groupings were put together into a single state because the British thought that they should be able to do that, fundamentally. They also, by the way, Iraq was the first of the mandatory states to get its independence because it was such a political basket case that the British decided that they don't need to be there anymore because the king of Iraq would be so dependent upon the British that he would be a British pawn forever. They created, for example, the mandatory powers inflamed sectarianism. For example, in Iraq, they gave the minority of the population, which was Sunni Arab, they gave them all the power. And this, of course, angered Shi'i Arabs, who were very, very, who were the dominant population in the area. The mandate system, for example, recognized the right of Jews to have a homeland in Palestine, which, of course, inflamed the sectarian issues there as well and the ethnic issues there as well. So you have economic problems created by the mandate system, political problems created by the mandate system. You have nationalisms that were inflamed by the mandate system because now, of course, the Syrians and the Lebanese had an object against which to direct their nationalist aspirations, which was the French, and the others, of course, had the British against which to direct their aspirations as well. But you had something else going on, finally, as well, which is that ultimately these governments, it took a long time for them, once they did achieve independence, and most of them achieved independence at the end of World War II, it took them a very, very long time to establish the legitimacy of their states to exist, not only for the governments to rule, but for the states themselves to exist. And in order to be able to push their legitimacy, what they had to do is contend with a whole range of other options, other types of nationalisms, Islamic movements, all sorts of other movements as well that didn't believe that the colonial powers should have had the right to divide these places up arbitrarily.
Hello, you're listening to the Logic Consortium in our interview with Professor James Gelvin about his book, The Modern Middle East. Now back to the interview. Thanks so much for listening. Professor Gelvin, you mentioned in the book how the United States really only became a major power in the Middle East in 1956. Can you talk about the U.S. objectives in the region during the Cold War and how the U.S. went about pursuing those objectives?
Yes. First of all, in terms of 1956, the United States always had an ambivalent position about the British and the French in the Middle East during the Cold War era. On the one hand, they felt that this, of course, would inflame nationalist passions in the region and also give entree to the Soviet Union. So they were very much against forces of colonialism. But then again, on the other hand, they saw the British and the French as providing stability in the region as well. So the British and the French were providing stability and instability. At the height of the Vietnam War, for example, when Prime Minister Harold Wilson of Britain announced that the British were going to withdraw from all their bases east of Suez, the United States actually offered to pay for British colonialism. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, the United States helped the British out during the so-called Mossadegh crisis when the government of Iran nationalized the British petroleum interests in Persia in 1953. And as a price for that, a new consortium, oil consortium, was set up that was not exclusively British anymore. That included the Americans now. So there was this constant ambivalence about empire in terms of the Americans and the Middle East. Throughout the Cold War, though, and this is a strange thing to actually think about, American policy was actually fairly consistent. You can compare policy in the immediate post-war era with policy in the Reagan administration. There were pretty much six goals that the United States had in its Middle East crisis. The most important one, of course, was the containment of, in the Middle East. The most important was the containment of the Soviet Union, of course, and that drove all of American policy throughout the Cold War period. And the United States went through all sorts of shifts in terms of the tactics that it employed. Once the Cold War was over, and the central pillar of American Middle East policy, which was to exclude that region from the grasp of the Soviet Union, or from having the Soviet Union having too much influence there, as soon as that was gone, American policy became a shambles. And hence, what you have was a brief period of no policy, and then a period in which you have this global war on terror and the birth of a new Middle East, as Condoleezza Rice put it.
Could you talk a little bit about how the history we just reviewed led to nationalistic movements in the Middle East and later to Islamist movements?
Well, it's actually very interesting because if you look at the nationalist period, at the point at which people began to consider themselves part of some nation state or multiple nation states in the region, and this goes back to the mid-19th century when, for example, people, the Ottomans pushed the idea that they were all Ottomans and had an Ottoman nationalism. What we see is the emergence of a variety of nationalism. Some of them were ethnic, some of them were linguistic, and some of them were also Islamic. In other words, the nationalist with the linguistic nationalists in the 19th century into the 20th century would say, we're all Arabs based on our language, or we're all Armenians based on our language, or we're Turks based on our language. The ethnic ones would say, again, Arab ethnicity or Turkish ethnicity or Persian ethnicity. And the Muslim nationalism, the Islamic nationalism that emerged around the same time, that the distinguishing characteristic they gave to the Muslim nation or to whatever nation they were going for was that it was Islamic. Islam became a marker of nationality. Now, it just so happened that around the time that these countries were getting their independence, most of the nationalist movements were secular, were not religious at all. And there's a good reason for that. A nationalist movement wants to unite as much of the population as possible, so they're not going to exclude people from the nation on the basis of their religious beliefs, for example. And it's much easier to unite the entirety of a nation around language, for example, or ethnicity, one of those characteristics, than it is around religion. In terms of religion, however, that never really entirely disappeared as a cultural marker, as a nationalist marker. And it began to reemerge again as an important political movement, these Islamic movements, in the 1970s as a result of a couple of reasons. Number one, the most important was probably, or the most important two, let's put it that way, was the demonstration effect of the Iranian Revolution, where people said, you know, you had a nationalist movement in Iran in 1953, and that was easily defeated by the West, by the Americans and the British. And you have an Islamic movement in 1978-79 that could kick out the Shah, who was an American puppet, as they looked at it. So maybe there is something to be gained from, you know, following an Islamic movement, that Islam itself could become a marker that would be very important for organizing your anti-colonial, anti-Western ideology. And that's one thing. The second thing that was of importance in terms of religious movements was the oil price rises of the 1970s, which all of a sudden took this relative backwater of the region, the Gulf, particularly Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, and gave them enormous wealth, and that wealth was in part used to spread a certain type of Islam, throughout the Middle East. There was large amounts of aid that was given, schools that were built, for example, religious institutions, mosques, charities, et cetera, that were subsidized by petrodollars, by money that was accumulated after the price revolution of 1973. And so the combination of these two things, plus on top of that, the failure of the secular regimes, and there were multiple failures. They never could deliver on their economic promises. The Arab regimes were totally humiliated in 1967 during the 1967 Arab-Israeli War. The failures on the part of the secular regimes and the possibility of success and the economic basis for these movements in the 1970s began to tilt the balance in the Middle East towards Islamic movements. And that's why we see what we see, you know, now.
I mean, you also mentioned how these movements were really a direct response to Western imperialism, and the way religion plays a role here is really truly a modern phenomenon. Can you talk about this a little bit?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. In the sense that if we look at political Islam, and as I said before, political Islam is very much of a fraternal twin, you could say, of secular nationalism. Both of these types of movements, the Islamic movements on the one hand and nationalist movements, were born out of the creation of the modern nation-state system and the creation of states within those systems that would, for example, fight for sovereignty, fight for economic development, et cetera, et cetera. So once you have this sort of thing taking place, these movements either using non-religious or religious markers in order to justify and assert their right to sovereignty, it's a matter of contingency which type of movement is going to succeed. And as I stated before, you had the multiple failures of the secular state. You had the fact that, you know, the Iranians were able to pull off their revolution. You had money backing these Islamic movements. So these are the Islamic movements, which in large measure replicate the same structures as the secular nationalist movements. These Islamic movements were able to come to the fore in the last 20 years or so. It's pure contingency. It's not determined. It's not genetic in terms of, well, of course, Middle Easterners are going to eventually realize that they can't really be nationalists and they have to be, you know, their identity is really Muslim and not this, that, or the other thing. No, it's not that at all. Various identities that people adopt are fundamentally based upon contingent events, and that there's always been Islamic movements. There's always been secular nationalist movements since the beginning of nationalism in the region. And it's just, as I said, outside events that's going to determine which is going to be able to find maximum support within the region.
You're listening to the Logic Consortium in our interview with Professor James Galvin about his book, The Modern Middle East, explaining how today's movements are really modern in the sense that they are responses to recent events. So please stick around. Thanks so much for listening. Delving a little bit into the Arab-Israeli conflict, you mentioned how this conflict has had a broad effect on the region, reinforcing the tendency to find military solutions to political problems by allowing governments to say they're in a permanent state of war. Can you talk about this a little bit and the effects it's had on the region?
In a way, the Israel-Palestine conflict has been overblown in importance. And in another way, you can say that there is no way of exaggerating the importance of the Israel-Palestine conflict. When you look at the Israel-Palestine conflict, you're dealing with, first of all, a very, very small amount of territory and a very, very small number of people. There are 6.5 to 7 million Israelis, for example. There's 10 times that number of Turks, Persians, or Egyptians. There have been, since the inception of the State of Israel, approximately 125,000 casualties in various Arab-Israeli wars. Now, that's a tragedy, of course, but the number of casualties for example, the Iran-Iraq War, which lasted only 8 years, has been estimated to be between 1 and 2 million. And that's why, on the one hand, you could say it's been exaggerated. On the other hand, you can say that a lot of financial resources on both sides, the Israeli side and Arab state side, has been devoted to military expenditures, and Arab economic development has in part been stultified by that, that particularly in the Arab countries, as you mentioned, the idea of a permanent state of war has been used as an excuse by regimes to hold them onto power and to prevent any sort of popular movement, anti-government popular movement from taking root. And it's also exacerbated a feeling of dislike for the West, which you see throughout the Middle East. That being said, I've never had anybody in the Middle East that I've spoken to say, on the one hand, that they really hate the United States government for supporting Israel without first saying, you know, I really like Americans, but your government is doing awful stuff.
You talk about in your book how there's really this tendency kind of in the United States to lump together all these Islamist political movements. Can you talk about their diversity a little bit?
There are three fundamental groupings within political Islam. First of all, you have what could be termed reformists, social democrat type, democratic types, or Fabians, people like that who think that what they can do is over a long term, they could join parliaments, they could join political parties, and and actually work within the structure of the existing state to make their program more viable, make it actually come to life, impose its program. And you see that, for example, in Jordan or in Egypt, where in Jordan, for example, you actually have an Islamic political party that's entered into parliament. In Egypt, of course, the largest Islamic group is not allowed to participate in politics, but people know which parliamentarians are associated with the group, the Muslim Brotherhood. And so it's really an open secret that they do participate in politics. So you have the reformists on the one hand. Then you have the people that I call in other venues Islamo-nationalists, Hamas, Hezbollah. These people want to take over the reins of the state and utilize that to change the nature of the state itself. And among the changes that they want to do is to Islamize society through the state. The Taliban is a good example of a group that is, at least one wing of the Taliban, a group that is interested in doing something like that, taking over the state, using it to create a better Islamic society. Movements like that are at work in, for example, Somalia as well, in the Sudan, various other regions. And finally, we have those groupings, some that are often referred to as jihadi or Salafist movements, movements such as Al-Qaeda, which are not interested actually in joining the state system. They're not interested in taking power of an individual state. They're not interested really in creating a super Muslim state made up of all Muslim societies. They war against the state system itself. They say that the state system was set up by the Zionist Crusader conspiracy to keep Muslims weak, and what Muslims have to do is to get rid of the international system, the United Nations, various international institutions like the IMF, etc., and establish a, well, they're very vague on that, some form of caliphate in which Sharia law will be practiced, but not like a real state. And in this, Al-Qaeda is very, very similar to anarchist movements that have emerged in various parts of the world. So if we look at political Islam, we have, for example, the ameliorists, the reformists, those who enter into parliament to form political parties, political lobbies. We have the nationalists, those who want to take power in a variety of ways and utilize that power to Islamize society and redefine the nature of the state And they also, by the way, want to maintain, they want to join the state, the international state system. They just want to do it on their own terms. And hence, for example, the best example of that is the Iranian regime. And then finally, those who war against a system that they view as being repressive want to just bring it down. Again, with a vague formulation of what they want to do in the future. And those are what I refer to in my work as Islamo-anarchist groups like Al-Qaeda.
And kind of to wrap up, as you mentioned, there is a school of thought out there that gets play in some circles, following professors such as Samuel Huntington, who assert that the world is divided into different civilizations, which are irreconcilable because they hold an entirely different value systems. How does everything that we have discussed in this interview inform the discussion of whether or not there is a monolithic Islamic civilization with the doctrinal mandate of jihad that cannot be swayed or negotiated with?
I think that the clash of civilizations thesis has been so gone through and picked apart. I'm sure your listeners have probably formulated opinions of their own by now, you know, on that. Obviously, Islam is not, first of all, Islam is, I'm not quite sure what Huntington means by civilization. He uses the term in a variety of different ways in his book. There are a varieties of Islamic practices. A great majority of Muslims, for example, do not hold that jihad is a means armed struggle and is an individual duty. That's a very minority view within the Islamic community, on the one hand. In addition to that, there's this interesting story that I was talking to a Chinese scholar, and he was mystified by the idea of a clash of civilizations between Christendom and Islam, a monolithic Christendom and Islam. He told me, you know, people who make that argument don't understand that the way we look at it from China is that Islam, Christianity, Judaism, they're all the same. There is no clash of civilizations there. If you want a clash of civilizations, it's between us who don't have this Abrahamic religion or monotheism or so on and so forth in the way that you do, and you guys, all of you together. So there's a whole variety of ways of looking at this whole clash of civilizations problem. Islam, as I said, is certainly not monolithic. There's a variety of ways of practicing Islam. There is a variety of tendencies within the Islamic world, some of which are very secular, some of which are not. There's a wonderful book that came out a couple of years ago called Being Muslim, the Bosnian Way. Bosnian Muslims, by the way, love their slivovitz, their plum brandy, and they love to eat pork. Okay. Now, this is certainly not the sort of thing that Osama bin Laden and his ilk would approve of. So the idea of coming out with this idea of monolithic civilizations is just, it's insipid. And I'm rather surprised that somebody as notable as Samuel Huntington would actually try to push.
You're listening to Logic Consortium, and that was our interview with Professor James Gelvin about his book, The Modern Middle East. Thanks so much to Professor Gelvin. Visit us online, logicconsortium.blogspot.com, also at iTunes, and thanks so much to Matt Hudson and Scientific Map for this great music. Have a great day.